Hari Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Brinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Page 44, Adi Karna 6. The Atma of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 4.5.6 is the Supreme Brahman and not the Jiva. Vyakyan Adi Karanam. So here, Atma is the word in discussion. The Sharikya followers confront the Vedantas professing Atma to be the Jiva. Given that the knowledge of Atma leads to complete knowledge and liberation, Atma refers to the Supreme Brahman and not the Jiva, since the Jiva doesn't possess these features, right? So again, now they're trying to use this word Atma here to refer to the Jiva, because they're always going to bring it back to the Jiva and Prakriti. They're not actually bringing out the Brahman, because that's not their idea. Their idea is, Pradhan is the Supreme, and so then it's just a matter of interacting there. And then the jivas, then they're interacting with Pradhan in its manifest state. They're trying to enjoy Pradhan in the state of not being supreme. I mean, Pradhan as unmanifest, and so therefore Pradhan manifests, and then that's their idea. Does that make sense? So if you have knowledge of yourself, then that will solve all the problems. What they're missing is that the supreme Atma, that's the actual position. Right? Sutra reference 1.4.19-22, Adhikarna Prakashika. This Adhikarna aims to prove that by knowledge of the Supreme Lord, all that there is to know within this universe may be known. Not so by knowing of the individual soul alone. Earlier, Brahman was described as the sole object of inquiry. It was described therein that knowledge is of two times. Paroksha, the means, and aparoksha is to achieve him. Right? Because paroksha, you hear from others. But aparoksha means you experience. Right? Because that's the process. You hear from shabda, then by contemplation through anuman, you bring it to the point of pratyaksha where you actually experience it. Does that make sense? The difference is between here is that aparoksha means that in experiencing, you're not actually focusing on the thing itself. You're focusing on the activities that produce the experience. Right? As soon as we try to focus on the experience, then actually you lose the experience. Like if you're interacting, let's say, with somebody and it's a very nice time, if you focus on that this is a nice time, you're not interacting, so it's generating the niceness is gone. You understand? So that's the weakness in trying to enjoy things, because as soon as you try to enjoy them, the process that creates the enjoyment is no longer functioning. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Paroksha, it means the means. So can you say then paroksha is like the process of devotional service?
Which paroksha?
Mm-hmm.
No, that means you're hearing about it. Then when you're applying that, then that's your aparoksha. It's the means that, that's what you've heard. Then when you actually use it. So that's the point, is that you hear in shravana, but then you apply it in manana. So that means you're contemplating and applying it there. Vedanta, so that's from Vedanta Sutra 112. Okay? Means that is the sole object, Tato Brahma Jigyasa. Yeah.
Janmadi Yasyata.
Then put it.
That should be put? Because it's like this.
If you're going to be at every class of every teacher, so when they come to this and they don't know what it is, you're going to say it, then you don't put it. But if you want them to know that this is what it is, you put it. You understand? Because you're working on the premise that, of course, everybody knows, but most people, their minds aren't like a bear trap, they're more kind of like a colander. You know colander?
Yes.
Yeah. So therefore, all these things go out through the holes. There's so many holes. Here there's three numbers. Three numbers go out through the holes really easy. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So, in other words, yes, this is not, means our presentation is not the tastiest for those who are really intelligent. The subject matter is, but our presentation is not. Because those who are really intelligent like to leave it like this. They have to know, they have to contemplate, they have to do the work. Our point is we'll hand it to them already peeled and without the seed. You understand? So it's about appreciating what's there rather than going through the intellectual process. Does that make sense? So, yeah. Scriptures.
Maharaj, even good or bad experience, when we judge, we disconnected from the experience.
Yes. Just like if you're having a bad experience, if you start to analyze it, you're not actually connected with it. You can maintain the attachment of being connected with it. So, 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 so.
When they say Atma here and Jiva, no, both terms are the same. They equate.
That's what the Charikya followers are saying. That's their whole philosophy. That this is the same.
But what we are saying
is no. That Atma means the Supreme Brahman.
So we say that's like Paramatma.
Yes.
Because usually we
Paramatma, Parabrahman.
Because we use Atma as Jiva?
We generally, but that's the whole point of this section, is that it's all the terms that can be used either way.
Yeah. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's the... Does that make sense? So... Hence, one who knows the Supreme Lord knows that there is nothing else to be known except for the Supreme Lord. Sages declare that as soon as one attains liberation, his only satisfaction is the Supreme Lord's own blissful qualities. Such is the relationship between the soul and the Supersoul. The Supreme Lord resides within the living entity as the Supersoul. He is full of knowledge, the greatest living entity, and limitless. So that's what the Vaishnavas get. For these other schools, that's not what they're looking for. They're simply looking for liberation or enjoyment. They're not looking for beyond this. Because they don't know there's something beyond it. That's why they don't look. So that's why the Vaishnava Vedanta then has to establish this point. Because it can't be known by intelligence. It's only known by what comes down through the parampara. Does that make sense? So that's why for us, it's more important what the acharyas are saying. What they're bringing out. And then all the technical points they do, how they do. And then we take that and we use it. It's not that we ourselves have to figure it out when we're studying it. Right? One may say, but then what do? We have to apply it. Right? Probably gives the example that you're taught to learn to fly an airplane, but no one can be there when you're flying it. You have to fly it yourself. Right? People can give you advice, but they can't fly it for you. So that's where it goes. So in other words, our emphasis is on Abhideya. We're studying the Sambandhi Gyan so that we can apply it. Because that's the difference between technically the Vaishnavas and the scholars. Is the scholars, it's all about all about contemplating the knowledge. It's not actually about applying the knowledge. Because most people in their own field, they never apply it. Those that do, generally they're more respected, like a doctor, a lawyer, or a physicist. Like they're more respected. But people who just do something, have another discipline, they're not respected as much because what do you do with it? How do they apply it? They actually never apply it. right? Someone's an expert, the world expert on ancient Greek literature. But does he apply it in his life? No. It's just a point of interest. So it's only the sambandha aspect that they get into. Because we have to remember, sambandha includes the discussion about Abhideya and Prayojana, but it's only a discussion. So that's as far as they want to take it. That's the difficulty with conclusions. Because Siddhanta means now this is what's to be done. They don't like that. It means they're totally allergic to this. I mean, like, you know, clinically, means that they have to go in the ICU if they bump into conclusions. Like that. Life support, you know, the whole thing. Like that. Because it means, for them, the end of speculation. Does that make sense? So that's the whole idea, is how to make things as clear as possible. Because even if they're as clear as possible, doesn't mean we're going to apply it. Right? How much of times have we heard, you know, Goloka era prema don harinam samkirtan. It's come down from Goloka Vrindavan. Here's the holy name, non-different from Krishna. By chanting Hare Krishna, you're directly associating with Krishna. And we'll say, yeah, I've heard that. But do we do it? That's another question. You understand? So that's why in the study part, in the sambandha part, we make it as direct as possible, as straightforward as possible, as clear as possible. And that's why you won't see this kind of study anywhere else. Because who's going to do this kind of study?
Intellectuals.
So they're going to look at it. That means if you're not smart enough to figure it out, why are you reading this? Does that make sense? But our position is, if you're not interested to apply it, why are you reading this? That's the difference. That's why, even though we're discussing Vedanta Sutra, it doesn't carry that flavor of academia. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's the principle. Because we see as the acharyas how they give. It's very nice. It's very technical. They can give all the technical points, but it's not about the technical points. It's just the technical points are very effective. That's why they're used. But it's about the result they'll get, the how that will please Krishna. That's then the whole point. Just, yes?
They don't have faith. That's why they don't want to fight.
Yeah, because it's not about faith. It's just like they have faith in the speculative process, but it's not the specific thing. You know, maybe there's a liking that they have a faith that, okay, this particular area of knowledge will give me the ability and taste in speculating. But it's not in the applying it. Does that make sense? So that's why, in one sense, the for understanding Vaishnavism, actually the karmis are in a better position. Because they know if you don't apply it, you don't get the results. At least the ones that are getting results. The smart ones. So that's why it's easier for them. Because it's not about negating things, it's not about the speculation, it's about the application. And it's about engaging the senses. While for the jnanis, it's not about engaging senses. Right? They probably still haven't figured out that they have them. You know, like that. Does that make sense? So the concept of relationship, engaging the senses and all that, it's easier. That's why then we see that in Krishna and Gita explains karma yoga, that's not enough. Then he explains jnana yoga. That's not enough. Then he combines them. That's then what we use. Like that. Does that make sense? And that's being done meditating on Krishna. So that becomes bhuti yoga. So that's the thing. Is our technical process, our mechanical process, is bhuti yoga. That's what we're into. Because it's how to combine all of them. And it's so perfect that doesn't matter which is the major aspect in the proportion at any one time. The point is to be engaged, because this body, mind, and words are engaged. So if the body's engaged, that's karma yoga. The mind is engaged, that's jnana yoga. The words are engaged, that's jnana yoga. So at any one point, one of them may stand out. You know what I'm saying? like that. You know, it's like the Grihastha is dealing with family members who are having a very difficult time. You know, something emotional or something as that happened. Now, the way to correct it, as we've seen it being used in the Bhagavatam by everyone, is they use Jnana Yoga. They explain the philosophy. They break it down and analyze, because as soon as you analyze it, you're not actually experiencing it anymore. You can remember it from the past, but now you're having to deal in the present. Right? Does that make sense? So, on the material platform, that works great. But we see when Uddhava tried to use that same technique on Nanda Maharaj, it didn't work, because in the spiritual world, there's no time. So even if you're thinking of Krishna in the past, that's the present. And so it didn't break the meditation. Like that, you understand? But here, then, they'll use that. So Jnana Yoga is used so to bring us to a Krishna conscious position. But you see, it's Jnana Yoga being used in the context of Karma Yoga. You know, family life and all these aspects. Does that make sense? And you're trying to bring about something where you were remembering Krishna. So that's the Jnana Yoga. So that's the thing, is it all works perfectly. So, does that make sense? That's the thing, is that we analyze them separately so that we know the components. But when you apply it, they're all done together. You know, it's like making a chance, putting some vegetables in the pot, stirring them around, then putting a lid on it. Okay? So now they're frying, at the same time they're steaming. So you're doing two processes at once. And by the two, you actually get a better flavor than if you just fried it or just steamed it. And so that's the thing, is that goes together. But you have to know how the two work. You have to know how each one works to be able to combine them.
That's for analyzing.
Yes, for analyzing. So that's where then it comes in. So that's where we're using this technical intellectual process. But it's not about the taste of the intellectual process, right? It's about being able to understand so we can use it. That's the uniqueness of this approach. Because it doesn't have the airs of academia. You know what I'm saying? Because in our movement, we've tried to do that. Different institutes have come up to do an academic kind of flavor. You know, especially in the Sanskrit approach. And where are these students? Where are these schools? Right? Because it's just about the taste of it rather than the application of it. It's about knowing, expanding what you know rather than expanding what you do. We get more knowledge to apply more. Right? Why learn more recipes if you're not going to cook them? You know, that's the point. Is that? Yeah. Yes?
Nowadays, Maharaj, among the devotees, it's a very popular approach. It's called empathic listening.
Yes.
Means you don't apply philosophy, you don't judge them.
No,
no
judge.
You judge them, that's it.
Yes.
It's an emotional.
No, I understand.
And many times.
Yes,
and
yes.
Then you,
no,
you kind
you're
of
right.
Pretend as if you hear like very attentively.
Yes, yes.
And people.
But we're actually listening to the Bengalis outside.
Apparently happy from that. We don't apply philosophy, no logic, no nothing.
Yeah.
Is that a good way to
do it? You can start there. It means it just depends upon who the person you're dealing with and their mental state. So you have to combine that. You know, the situation you're in, the mental state, the particular, you know, intensity of all that. You can start there. That's why we say Buddha Yoga is so perfect, because it uses all of them, while in this modern thing, you only use one of them, and they say the whole thing is that one.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, unless they have it right, it's not the one. You know, because the point is Krishna's the one. So you can start there, but then from that, when they feel comfortable, then you start bringing in the philosophy. Because unless you analyze the situation you're in, how do you actually overcome? If by being empathetic, I simply increase their attachment and increase their, intolerance, then what's the point? You know what I'm saying? Because if I increase the intolerance, that increases their need for retribution. So how are they going to get any benefit? Does that make sense? If that's all you do, because then you can feel, yes, I did something very nice, so I can feel, yes, I'm helping, I'm a friend. Because that's the whole point. Emphatic listening means we're friends. Because if we're friends, that's kind of the nice, it's kind of like saying that it's a personal form of actually impersonalism. Because we're not friends. Because if we don't get close and this and that. You know what I'm saying? Because all this goes because it's about being equal. So equal then is the friendship. And so that you want to bring out. But that equalness means you have to be friends with everybody. Like I just heard yesterday that one of the newest things in the American and English or UK theories in the school system is children shouldn't have best friends. Because if they have best friends, they're being exclusive and excluding everyone else, and so they have to be all-inclusive. So they should be nice with everybody. So they can't train them how to be proper and nice and give culture and etiquette because their philosophy is about themselves. Right? They say it's about everybody, but it's about yourself. Right? And so they can't actually train people in character and culture. So they see that there's a fault. Okay, they're always with this group, and so by being there, excluding others, others feel bad. But they take the extreme cases, you know, the what do you call it? The cheerleaders, you know, they hang out with themselves and everybody else are idiots, you know, or the guys in the trench coats or in the corner that when they get upset enough, then they get out there, you know, whatever weaponry they have and shoot the school up, you know. And these are all because they're tight friends and they exclude everyone else. So therefore, no one should have any friends, even though that's the, you know, it's like the smallest group. How many cheerleaders are there in a school? Right? 1,000 kids and there's how? 5 of them? You know? Like that. And how many of the other guys? There's 3 of them? You know, so for 8 people, then that means then 992 people should not have friends.
How can you apply this?
They tell the kids that you can't hang out, you have to be with everybody else. No, this is a real live thing. I just heard about it yesterday. So they're discouraging, huh?
But those who say this, are they with everybody else?
Are they?
Are they with everybody else?
No, because they'll only be with those that agree with them. So that's the whole problem, is that these things are, they are presented as if they're very nice and that they'll solve the problem. But unless the soul actually improves the quality of their mental state, then just because you've dealt with qualities doesn't mean you have anything. Because what are qualities for? Why will qualities develop? So we can say as everybody should be good, everybody should be nice, but why? What's the purpose? You know, oh, then we'll be nice together, everybody will be happy. But what's the whole point of this? How do you be happy? How do you define all those things? Does that make sense? So then the difficulty comes up is that in trying to define that, then they actually have no higher purpose. You're not actually improving the quality of human life. You're not bringing it to human form. I mean, human life. Human life starts at monomoi. So that means you have higher rules that govern the application of the soul. And so then in that application, then they are able to elevate themselves to the transcendental position. But otherwise, if you're functioning before that, you can say it's better than the, you know, totally uncivilized life. But only that it's a sophisticated animal rather than a unsophisticated one. Or a cooperating unsophisticated animal rather than, you know, an uncooperating one. So you haven't actually got it beyond. So it's only when there's the higher purpose. And even that is still as selfish until you get to bhakti. Only at bhakti it stops being selfish. So the emphatic listening can be used when there's someone's having a very difficult time, but it can't be used for everything. It's only, you know, it's just like you have a very good medicine for, let's say, malaria. You know, it's a strong fever, it's this and that. So do I use malaria anytime there's a fever? The medicine? No. So that's the whole point. is that unless you can actually understand what the problem is, then you can't use. So you can use that just to catch their attention, that they feel comfortable, so that they'll listen to actually something that will improve their consciousness. Does that make sense? And you have to take it at the speed that someone can do like that. It doesn't mean that things aren't going to be slow. But the point is that you know where you're taking it. So when the opportunity is there, you take it to that point. Does that make sense? But if you don't know, if you think that that's enough, then you'll have done something when more is necessary. You know, it's like first aid. That's all it's good for, is first aid. It's important, but it's only for first aid. Then after that, the paramedics show up, and then after that, the hospital. So you have to take it up. But if, you know, the guy's cut off his arm and you just kind of put it back on and put a Band-Aid and say, there, that's nice, it'll be all right. And, you know, I mean, it's not actually very intelligent. Yes?
Because as you mentioned in the Bhagavatam, we see that even Hiranyakashipu, after the death of his brother, he's using strong philosophy, which is very masculine kind of approach to the situation, and he does it.
Yeah, because that's the nice one. You should see what women do in those situations.
he talks both to women and men, and yes, they agree to that.
Because you're working on the platform of the soul.
But nowadays, unless you use a feminine approach as, you know...
No, but that's the point, is that, because do they need to... What's the important part of the conversation there? Right, his Vedanta philosophy. So they don't need to explain. Because remember, when he first walked in, he was really angry, he was really this and that, he vowed he's going to kill Vishnu. That's the emphatic part. And after that, then he gets into the philosophy. Because he makes the connection. And then having made the connection, I discuss the philosophy. So the two have to go together. It's not that, oh, it's masculine or feminine. It means they both go together. But it's just for the situation, how much do you have to use of each? So you might find one situation using more feminine, less masculine, or the other way around, or a balance, or it goes back and forth. Because if you start to lose them on the one, then you have to go back to the other. So it's just a matter of what works. Does that make sense? Yeah. So both are there. It's never one or the other. It's just that in this, those kind of things, those are just regular standard things, so they're not discussed. What's special is the philosophy. That's why it's put there. Yeah.
So here we are discussing about like how our emphasis is on Abhideya.
Our emphasis is on Abhideya, but to apply Abhideya, you have to know Prayojana. I mean, Sambandha. Right? Because otherwise, if you don't know the whole field, you don't know what you're dealing with, and what's the application, what's the goal, how do you actually apply it? And then, applying it, then you're applying that with all these three aspects. Right? What is the field? What is the application? What's the goal? So like, does that make sense? Yes. So Abhideya is applied with the knowledge of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. That's why you get Prayojana. Because okay. Abhideya means the means that actually gets you the results. So since the results are to develop love for Krishna, then those things that are, that do that, right, these five main things that Lord Chaitanya says, that's Abhideya. Everything else isn't Abhideya until you connect it to that. That's the point of the indirect. Indirect becomes Abhideya by being in the fire of Abhideya, by connecting it to. Right? It means we take our morning bath to go to the temple to take darshan of the deity, to be involved in the deity worship, which is one of the five. Right? So in that way, then our morning bath then becomes part of that process. But if it's not connected to that, you just get up in the morning and take a bath, you know what I'm saying, and then go on Facebook, then it's not connected. You know, it's a pious activity. It'll maintain the body in good health, but it's not spiritual. So unless we see it in connection with the spiritual, it's not Abhideya, technically. It means we'll say it's there, but it's because it's these are things to be, the secondary can be used in the primary. Right? So, but if the primary is not there, then it's ignorance. That's the whole point. Aparavidya means it's secondary knowledge that naturally is used in the primary, or paravidya. But if it's not used that way, it's not called aparavidya. The same exact knowledge is called avidya. Does that make sense? So it's not that it's a different branch of knowledge. We may tend to take it that way. But actually, it's just any knowledge not used for Krishna is avidya. So even Shankara is using his Vedanta commentary. That's avidya.
So in the same context, like Krishna says that one should not give up his occupational duty.
Yes.
Because that also is like holds on to application of what you...
Yes, yes. I mean, so you're supposed to have knowledge, right? You're supposed to do your duties. And you have to remember him and do it for him. So that means he's talking about all three. So all those have to be in place. And Krishna says that throughout the Gita. So, yes.
When it mentions over here, know the jiva as Brahman. And earlier we saw that the definition of Brahman was said to be the greatest.
Yes.
So if you substitute over here, then know the jiva as greatest. So that doesn't apply. So what is the actual definition of Brahman here written?
Means the greatest. The point is that...
But no, the jiva is the greatest. But
the jiva, that means then what is the greatest living entity? Because jiva means a servant, a living entity. Someone who does something.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you see this, that it's arguing over this one word of jiva, that's the difference between the Wadagalai and Tengalai and the Shris. Because they say Lakshmi's jiva.
Yeah.
And the others say she's not jiva.
Yeah.
But jiva in this context means servant. So she's the greatest of jivas. I mean, she is the servant of the Lord. All other living entities are her servant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But they somehow or another can't figure this one out. That's the advantage of a Chintaveda Veda Tattva. So something that splits the Sampradaya for us is like, you know, yeah, of course. You know, there's no contradiction in both these views. She's non-different from the Lord, but she's the servant of the Lord. So what's the problem in these two views for us?
Mm-hmm.
It's only if there's material desire, then there's a problem.
Mm-hmm. You heard about the same thing, about the knowledge, paroksha and aparoksha. So paroksha and aparoksha both are transcendental.
Paroksha and aparoksha are means by which you gain knowledge.
It's about paravidya, basically.
Yes, so then it would be that. Then what you've heard from the transcendental and then your application of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that application generates an experience. So that this is, the aparoksha points out the experience that you're gaining. That means you always have to be performing the activity.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? Because paroksha means what you've heard from others. Aparoksha means what you experience.
Okay.
What's not heard, what's experienced. Does that make sense? Yeah.
You say that you take bath and then you go on Facebook between the temple and that's...
No, what we're saying is just if you've taken a bath not in, you don't see it in connection to the Lord, then it's a pious activity.
But it's part of it.
If you see that morning program, that you're doing that because of spiritual life, then it becomes spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is it has to be connected to spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes spiritual. On its own, taking a bath, the birds take a bath.
Yeah. So where does the Facebook thing come in, that you've broken the meditation?
It just meant that you were taking your bath just so that you could, you know, be awake enough to, you know, appreciate Facebook.
Okay.
Otherwise you might fall asleep or drool on your computer, and that's really bad for the keyboard. You know, like that. Not as bad as, you know, dumping your can of soda over on the keyboard, but, you know. So,
they made a whole research that the filthiest thing in every office is the keyboard.
Everybody's
key. Yeah, I'm sure, because you type there, who knows where your hands are bent, you eat things there, they all find you. Yeah, no, there's someone here. Okay, so we're all good? Mario Brothers? No? Okay. Summary of Adikarna 6. 1. Vishaya. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 4.5.6, Yajnavalkya teaches his wife, Maitreyi. Nava, are, patyu, kamya, pati, priyo, bhavati. Nava, are, sarvasya, kamaya, sarvam, priyam, bhavati, atmanas, tu, kamya, kamaya, sarvam, priyam, bhavati, atmava. A husband is not dear because the wife loves the husband. A husband is dear because she loves the self. Right? Does that understand? Because we're thinking it's the husband. It's just a matter of where you're going to apply this attention. So we'll say that the husband is dear because we're applying our attention there. But actually, what is the husband? Right? The husband is the self, or the Supreme Lord. He's the one that's attractive. He's why we find that there is that feeling in that person. Right? Remember, the gopis were talking about this. So for us, this is, we can see is that it's either something above our head, because it's intellectual, or it's the tastiness is the intellectualness. No, it's the application. Because as we see is the gopis, this is just how they maintain their lives, away from Krishna in their homes. It's because they see everything connected to Krishna. Krishna is the self of everything in their home. This makes sense. He also says, everything is not dear because one loves everything. Everything is dear because one loves the self. Again, he says, the self should be seen, heard, worshipped, and always meditated on. O Maitreyi, by seeing, hearing, worshipping, and understanding the self, everything becomes known. Right? Because we're talking about relationship here. See, this is the technical thing, is that when Vedanta is understood in relationship to the Lord, it takes on that universal flavor. So it's not about it's only for intellectuals, it's only for men, it's only for this or that. It's about relationship with the Lord. And these are just technical ways in which you can appreciate that. But it's being shown in relationship to the Lord. Not meaning a connection to, means it's shown in relationship to the relationship with the Lord. That might make it more clear in English. Right? Does this make sense? So that's what makes it universal. That's why this is the only thing that actually cuts through all barriers. Anything else is dealing with the topical aspect of a conditioning. Well, this is not. Yes.
Just like Bhavan Shama, you always explain it's in connection with the Lord.
Yes, yes. So Daiva. So because it's connection with the Lord. Because otherwise, the Shankara approach to Vedanta is not in a connection with the Lord. Therefore, what's the point? And therefore, it's very dry. So that when we say, we're not saying philosophy is dry. We're saying mental speculation is dry. Because philosophy is not dry, because it's about Krishna. So... Right? So this is the whole point, is that self that you're talking about there. Right? Because he's saying they is the Supreme Lord. So then the doubt comes up. Now our Sharikyas, then they bring up their doubt. Shamshaya. In this passage, which self is to be understood? The Jiva, individual spirit soul, described in the Kapila Tantra. Or the Paramatma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, right? That's the doubt. Then they're now their, what do you call it?
Reasoning.
Their reasoning and their examples, their whole argument, right? Their whole presentation. Right? Yes. Because in this passage, he describes the love of husband and wife, and because in the middle of the passage, he says, Ete bhyo bhute bhya samutaya tan yevanu vin. Vina shati na preya sarj No, sar gyasti. He leaves the material elements. His body is destroyed. He dies and he is no longer conscious. Words that clearly describe a resident in the material world who is subject to birth and death. Because at the end he says, vigyataram are kena vigyaniyat. How should we understand the person who is the knower? This passage should be interpreted to describe the jiva, who is the knower described in the Kapila Tantra. Right? Because that's what they were, they always go back to that because that seems to be something that they can use very nicely to support their philosophy. But as pointed out before by Vyasadeva and Baladeva, then that's not what it's about anyway. But in any case, they like it. One may object, but it says that by knowing the self, everything becomes known. Certainly, this refers to the Paramatma, not the Jiva, right? Because that's what we would say. But this objection is not valid, they'll say. The Jiva takes birth in this world with an aim to enjoy, and one may figuratively say that by knowing the Jiva, one knows everything. For when one knows the world around him meant for his enjoyment, right? Because the whole point is Pradhan, their philosophy is that Pradhan's expanded into the material phenomena so the Jiva can enjoy. So if you actually know the Jiva, means their position in relation to Pradhan, then you know everything. But what they're missing here is Jiva's energy and Pradhan's energy. Where's the energetic? So you don't actually have knowledge unless you know the energetic. Right? Does that make sense? So when you know energy, energetic and its energy. So if you just know Brahman, you're knowing energetic, but not knowing energy. Right? In the impersonal understanding. So that's the difficulty, is that one has to know both. Like the discussion before, you have to know the masculine and the feminine. Because the point is without the feminine, how do you make the connection? But without the masculine, what's the point of connection? Does that make sense? Yeah. One may again object, this passage cannot refer to the jiva because the text says amritat vasya tu nashati, nashasti vitena. By knowing him, one becomes immortal. Notice when we're saying it, the him or self is always capital, and when they say it, then they always leave it in the lowercase because they're trying to refer to the jiva. Because it is only by knowing the Paramatma that one becomes immortal, how can this passage refer to the jiva? This objection is also not valid because by understanding that the jiva is by nature different from matter, one may also attain immortality. Yes, but it's a temporary immortality, therefore we don't call it immortality. Does that make sense? It's just like established rich don't consider nouveau rich, the nouveau riche, actually rich. You know, let it go some time. They got money now, they got today, but come back tomorrow, then they may have nothing. So they're not really considered. So in the same way as, yes, you can get liberated by knowing the soul. But the point is it's a temporary liberation because it's not actually real. You haven't given up the Karana Sharir, so you've not given up the principle of trying to be the controller and enjoyer. So you never actually get out of the Mahatattva. So then we would define that's not actually liberation. We'll call it liberation because in principle the general concept is the same. But in reality it's not. Does that make sense? Yeah. In the same way, all descriptions in this passage that seem to refer to Brahman should be understood to refer to the jiva. Right, giving those things, then they say all the others. You'll see that's also a common thing. Shankara uses it a lot. He'll describe one thing that he has some examples for that. But let's say there's another four or five things. Then he'll show the one thing and he'll say, like that, you'll understand the other four or five, though he has no evidence, no explanation. You understand? That's the funny part, the illusion. Because the jiva wants to think, I am God. Therefore, here they've so-called proved it. And so then immediately you think, yes, this is what I want. So you don't bother to notice that the other ones don't apply. This one technically doesn't apply, but the point is it has a little bit of something they can explain. And then they'll say, in the same way, all descriptions in this passage that seem to refer to Brahman should be understood to refer to the jiva, though they're not going to deal with them. Hence, this entire passage describes the jiva, right? So they just come to their own conclusions. In this way, it should be understood that the material nature, which is under the control of the jiva, is the original cause of the world. Right? So because we know that the material nature then is functioning under higher authority, so they take the jiva, means the living entity, as the principle behind it. So the material world's the cause, and the jiva is behind that, rather than the jiva and material world are energies of the Lord. You understand? So why it's attractive? Because then we're God. Anything that makes us God has to be good, right? That's why we came here. So that's why these philosophies have followings. You know, I want to be happy. So you can say, but I can't be happy if everybody else has got the happiness. So if it's all equal and everyone's trying to work together, then there's the possibility I can get some happiness. So I want that. I like that philosophy because I want to be materially happy. So if my conditioning is in that line, I'll be attracted by these kind of philosophies. Yes.
How the person, because, for example, person don't know the proper philosophy. He knows, but here in this situation, person opposed the real philosophy. He's standing on the point that I'd like to be the God. So
it's just like, okay, you should do this duty. But Prabhu, we're not the body. We chant Hare Krishna. We don't care for rules. That's a contemporary example of this. So you're taking the point and shifting the context. You understand? Just like one word has many meanings according to the context.
Yeah.
They just shift the context.
Yeah, but what will make them change their point? Because they stand on the point of the ignorance, basically, from our position.
Because if they're ignorant, then you don't have to surrender to God, right? Yeah. And if you're actually in knowledge, then you need to surrender. Because that's the natural position.
But when the person can accept real philosophy, because even he hears it,
one is by the Lord's grace, but there has to be an actually desire for it. So when he desires to actually know, then one will come in contact with someone who actually knows. So that's why we're only interested in selling diamonds, not glass. This whole idea is that, no, if we do like this, it'll be more popular, we'll at least reach more people. But if by reaching more people, they get less, then what's the point? You know? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You can give one person 100 euros, and they can do something with it. Or we can take that 100 euros and reach 10,000 people by giving everyone 1 cent. So isn't that better? 10,000 people? We benefited 10,000 people? Who's ever started a business with 1 cent, right? But 100 euros, you could start something. So that's the whole thing, is this idea of volume. It sounds so good because volume means it's all inclusive, we're all together, and it's all... What is this? You are me, and I am you, and we are all together. Right? Yeah. Okay. Siddhanta, in this matter is as follows. Okay. Sutra 1.4.19. Vyakyan Vayat. Vakya, statement. Anvayat, because of the connection. The context of this passage proves that Brahman is the object of discussion, right? Because the context. The whole point is you take it out of context. It's one of the fallacies within logic. It means you have the proper syllogisms. That's the main core of the logic, right? But then you also have things that aren't actually proper logic, right? But they may be used to establish proper Siddhanta, or they may be used to avoid Siddhanta. They're techniques that are used either by people who are unqualified or against people who are unqualified. In any case, there are four people who are not actually properly qualified. So one of them is called chala, right? Where you take and you shift the meaning. Does that make sense? We give it another meaning. Or we use a different word. That the word you said gives me this understanding. So then for me, a clear word to make that point would be something else. So then I'll say, you said this, when you actually didn't. Does that make sense? You know, so therefore, in this, we have to control the situation and all that. It says, oh, so then you're saying then, you know, we have to be dictators. You understand? No, he didn't say that. No, but you said we have to control. You know, but what does control have to do that? Just like you got to control your bladder, right? You know, so does that mean now you're a dictator on your bladder or something? You know? Yeah. Sutra Prakashika. Here the Sutrakar, in reference to the passages occurring before and after the current passage in discussion, demonstrates the object of discussion as Brahman and not Jiva. Sri Govinda Basya. Siddhanta. In this passage, the Paramatma and not the Jiva of the Kapila Tantra is described. Why? Because in the context of the whole passage, including what precedes and follows this quote, that is the appropriate interpretation. Three sages also confirm this interpretation. Right? So in other words, you have to see it's talking by, because it's discussing so many things all about the Lord, and it's not something else in between. Does that make sense? You know, so we're not, you can't talk about something else. You know, so it's not that you're talking about a recipe for cooking, and while you're talking about the different ingredients, at one time you say, so you should crush this spice and that, and now the person takes that, oh, now this is a political point and that you're crushing your enemies, or, you know. No, you're talking about cooking. No, but here you're saying crushing. Crushing means this. Yeah, but we're crushing the spices here. You know what I'm saying? So that's what's going on. The discussion's about Paramatma. But at this one point here, the word's being used that they can spin the word. Right? And then from that, then they'll say, and see, it's approved in this other scripture. But it's actually not, because it's not about, that's not the topic that's being discussed. So yes? No?
Yes.
Okay.
So they want to change the continuum.
Yes. They're trying to change the whole thing, because their whole point is that the jiva is the you know, the point, the cause of everything, and that means the cause behind the cause, you know, and then the material energy is what's doing everything. You know, so material energy is the source of what's happening. And just on its own it's doing. The jiva wants, and then the material energy makes it. Like that. So that the difficulty comes up is that so they'll look for anywhere where we'll support what they're saying. You know, it's just like there's something you want to do and you shouldn't do it, but if I find anything anywhere that says I can do it, then I'll bring that up. You know, some modern medical studies that shows that something that I would rather do, then that's what should be done. You know, like the medical studies have shown that someone who sleeps 20 hours a day, then he has much more, you know, he does better at everything because, you know, he only does 4 hours. So that means he can't mess things up as much as someone who's awake for longer. Like that. You know, so therefore, see, you know, I'm doing this for Krishna, or, you know, something that we get from the Apara Vidya. That will interpret that above the Paravidya, you know, like that. So we just use it as we like, because you'll see is that many times those who oppose the Vedic, you know, Varnashram the most, when it comes to position of authority, you know, that their dislike of authority, right, because that's the whole basis, they'll use the Varnashram rules against authority. Oh, you're a sannyasi, you're a guru, then you have to do this, 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 this. But you don't care for the rules. You know what I'm saying? So they only use it because it works for their position. Otherwise, then they really don't care. Does that make sense? Yeah. Hmm? Yes.
Well, we take their point of view, the opponents. Then, in their context, everything was talking about the jiva. So, in their context, that's correct.
Yeah, in their context, it's correct. But the point is, this: the scriptures are being described by people who already the context is established.
But the acharya established that context. So, when they follow Shankaracharya, means they are doing the correct thing in their mind. From the point of view.
But how do you define correct?
Following the authority.
Okay, they're following the authority. And then by following the authority, what's the benefit?
They get liberated. That's their idea. They are prayojana.
Okay, so then N is getting liberated. Now, is that the perfection of human life?
For them, yes.
But is it?
No.
So that's the whole point, is that there's what they feel, and the only reason that they will get what they do is because they follow these rules that are actually given in bhakti. So they have to have that devotion to the spiritual master, the scriptures, for their sadhana. And only then they're going to get the results, because they're using bhakti. Mm-hmm. But the point is that since what they're using is bhakti to get their results, the actual conclusion has to also come from bhakti. Because bhakti is the actual working principle.
We can stretch it even further, saying that in personal liberation, you're merging into the Lord. That's your bhakti.
But how do you express the bhakti if you're one?
You lose your identity.
Yeah, but I'm saying the point is how do you express that?
You don't bother the person.
No, but the point is you're not bothering the person, so that means it's separate.
I'm just saying that so, in their mind, that's correct.
But that's in their mind, but the point is yes, that they follow these things, that's why they'll get the benefit from it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like anybody follows any religious process, a philosophical process, if they stay true to that, they'll get the results that are supposed to be gained. But the point is then there's the reality. You understand? So whatever results they'll get will be because they are following that and are true to it. But the reality of what they'll get, that you have to see in context of what's actually real. Does that make sense? So someone will get his benefit because he follows those rules. But at the same time, if he doesn't follow the rules, then he's a problem. Does that make sense? So just like, let's say, in the modern society, there's rules that let's say, okay, boys and girls hang out together and this way work out their life. So that's not recommended in the scriptures. Humans don't do it like that. But amongst the Mlechas and Yamanas, that's the standard way they do it. So, but you still have to be committed to the standard set by those Mlechas and Yamanas. Does that make sense? You can't deviate from that. So in other words, they're following a process that's not actually correct. But there are correct elements within it, in that they're following authority, they're following what's the standard norms and everything like that. Does that make sense? So that's where they're getting their benefit, because of that aspect of bhakti. You know, those elements of the original thing. They're respecting authority, they're respecting the cultural norms, they're dealing properly, they're following, there's restrictions, there's etiquettes. So even though they're made up amongst their own community, still they're following them, they'll get the benefit of that within their community. But the overall real benefit on what's there in human life, and, you know, as according to the universal laws, there'll be a reaction for that. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Like, when they raise their doubt regarding who's to be known, the jiva or the paramatma, so it seems that they have this particular concept of paramatma existing. And
it's not, that means that they've raised the doubt about paramatma, that then that they have an understanding of paramatma. It's not necessarily that they do. Because what is defined is their understanding of Paramatma. Because generally in all these, they'll just take him as the manifestation, the best manifestation of goodness. But the general point is that that's just, they'll take it as others' concept. And so they'll say that that's not the concept, this is the concept.
Okay.
Like that. So whether they know about it or not, that doesn't mean that they evaluate or are committed to it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Bhagavatam verse reference. Srimad Bhagavatam 2.5.35. The Lord, Mahavishnu, although lying in the causal ocean, came out of it and divided himself as Hiranyagarbha. He entered into each universe and assumed the Virat Rup with thousands of legs, arms, mouths, heads, etc. So that's actually because it's about this Vishayavakya, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Right? That, what was this he was saying?
Husband is dear to the wife.
Okay. A husband is not dear because the wife loves the husband. A husband is dear because she loves the self. So that's the Virat Rup. So how the Lord enters it. So, therefore, Mahavishnu, although he's there in the causal ocean, came out of that, divided himself as Hiranyagarbha. We're seeing this aspect here. He's also divided himself as how you say, Vishnu, he's also divided himself as Shiva. Right? So as Sada Shiva, he takes care of the ignorance of the living entities, the false ego, and this kind of aspect like that. The destruction of things. As Hiranyagarbha, then he sees to the creation of things. And that aspect of that attractiveness that's there. Does that make sense? And then as the goal of things, you know, why you're interacting with that, because there's a particular goal or experience you'll get, that says Kirudakshaya Vishnu. Does that make sense? So, in this way, instead of just being the Supreme Lord, as he thinks in, while he's in Vaikuntha, when he's dealing with the Mahatattva, then he thinks that I'm the creator, maintainer, and destroyer. So this way, then, he divides himself as three. So then you get the guna avatars, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, like that. But actually, they're just servants and taking up the role of doing those activities for Krishna. But the potency of creation, the potency of destruction, of ego, ignorance, all that's coming from Krishna. So they're Shaktivesh avatars, right? But we can also see is behind that, Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is taking that thing of creation. Does that make sense? You know, so in that way then he's doing, so he's divided himself. So he's just one, but he divides himself and comes out of that ocean and goes into each universe and then is in the Garbhodak ocean. Does that make sense? And then from that he goes out of that and then becomes Kirudakshaya Vishnu and then enters into the hearts of all living entities. So we understand the context of how it's being explained. Right? It's not that he leaves and then there's no one there. Well, what happened to mine? You know, you go up and you have the Mahatattva, it's all painted nicely and everything there, and there's nothing there. What happened? Oh, that's when Mahavishnu left.
Like that is vikar.
Huh?
Vikar. Transformation.
Yes, that's it. Yes, like that. So then we have. So. Okay. Then Srimad Bhagavatam 7.3.34. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme, who in his unlimited, unmanifest form has expanded the cosmic manifestation, the form of the totality of the universe. He possesses external and internal energies, and the mixed energy called the marginal energy, potency, which consists of all the living entities. So he sees that all the energies in discussion, those are all him. So the internal is there, which they're not addressing, the external, which they're addressing, and the jivas, they're all coming from the Lord himself. Right? So he has that unlimited, unmanifest, doesn't mean he doesn't have a form. It just means that it's not materially manifest. Right? It's unlimited in that his potencies are unlimited, but he has a specific form of a specific size. Right? So, yeah, through his internal potency. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.3.4. The devotees with their perfect eyes see the transcendental form of the Purusha, who has thousands of legs, thighs, arms, and faces, all extraordinary. In that body there are thousands of heads, ears, eyes, and noses. They are decorated with thousands of helmets, and glowing earrings and are adorned with garlands. Footnote 16. Srila Prabhupada in his purport explains the process to see the form of the Lord. With our present materialized senses, we cannot perceive anything of the transcendental Lord, right? So it's materialized senses. That was answering your question the other day. Is that the spiritual body? So that means the spiritual body has to be covered, so then it becomes materialized. Just like we take material elements made of the material nature and spiritualize them. Right? Because ourselves, our senses and mind, it has become materialized. Right? So that's the point, is the energies can switch. It just depends upon what's your purpose. So if you're dealing with yoga maya or bhakti, then it'd be spiritual. And if it's not about Krishna, then it's material. So even something spiritual can be materialized by not connecting to Krishna. And something material can be spiritualized by connecting it to Krishna.
So does that mean that until we become pure devotees, we constantly live in an internal conflict between spiritual and material bodies? They all always oppose one.
Well, I don't think that they're like... I wouldn't go as far as that they're there and there's a whole war going on.
It seems like a war.
Yeah, but that's the mind and all that, because the mind thinks there's a difference when there isn't. How can there be a war when there isn't anything to have a war with? So the war is our thinking that we're material.
So it's mental.
It's mental. It's a mental war.
In the same thing about the material body and the spiritual body.
So material then, body and yeah. Spiritual body.
So in the process of devotional service, you know, what should happen is that, I mean, that should actually technically take place that the material body, one should realize one's spiritual body eventually, you know, while going in the process of bhakti.
One should realize one's spiritual body while performing the process.
Yeah, because just as a bud, you know.
Means I'm saying these things not that I don't understand. I'm saying it because so that others can hear.
Okay.
Does that make sense? That's why when you say it, I say it afterwards, and then don't think, oh, you don't understand, then you keep going. Does that make sense?
Just as a bud of a flower, you know, it is budding and we can see the flower eventually, and then the fully blossomed flower.
You can see the fully blossom. You can see the bud and then the fully blossoming flower, meaning the spiritual body.
Yeah. So then that is not happening, you know, because...
That's not happening.
Yeah, because then...
Why it's not happening?
Because nobody realizes...
Nobody realizes. Absolutely nobody. I mean, there isn't one soul who realizes.
I mean, to say that everybody should realize, you know, what's going on.
Everybody should realize what's going on.
Yeah, because all of a sudden, how can the spiritual body just manifest overnight? You know,
how can it just manifest overnight? So the whole thing of the gopis surrendering in one moment and all that, then that's just hogwash. Because it's a matter of consciousness. You fully surrender to Krishna, and it's there. We're not dealing with something gross here, because the point is that the form remains the same. But now we're functioning with spiritual mind, spiritual intelligence, spiritual senses, spiritual consciousness. So then we're functioning through that spiritual body.
Some say that.
Some say. I thought you said nobody before. Now we have some.
No. It's the continuation. This.
Continuation. Okay. Some say.
That Krishna, he doesn't allow us to know how much we are advanced, because we may
Krishna doesn't allow us to know how much we're advanced.
Because we may become proud.
Because we may become proud.
So
and what's the point? What is the point about Krishna doesn't allow us to know how much we're advanced because we become proud? How does that apply to in this context?
This is in the context of the same thing, material body and spiritual body.
So it means Krishna doesn't allow the spiritual body to manifest, because otherwise then we become proud that we're in a spiritual body.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is what I've heard.
This is what you have heard.
It's mine. So, it didn't make any sense to me, therefore I'm asking you to write this.
The whole point is that the spiritual form then is there. It's covered by the material form. Right? Because we identify with it. That's our identity. So we take this up. But the point is while we're here, that's what's going to be manifest through. Because the point is spiritual body means engaging in Krishna service. It's not about what particular form it is. Because for us, it's about being able to be engaged in devotional service. Right? Does that make sense? So we have our duties, we do our duties, and that's what we do. So then what's the problem? Because it's not that physically here you do, it's through meditation that someone may have come to the point of realizing their position to be able to function on that because they've come to the platform of bhava. And so then through meditation, they'll render service in their spiritual body. So you don't have a problem that is going to happen here. You know, it's not like the super ecstatic kirtan, and at the end of the kirtan, then you have all these people there in the spiritual bodies, and who's who, and you don't know, and anything like that. Does that make sense? You know, the brahmachari's there, and it turns into a gopi, and all the other brahmacharis say, you got to stand over there. Like that. Or what happens if someone turns into a cow, right, in the middle of the temple room, right? You know, like that. You know. You understand? So that you don't have to worry about these things. These are... Yes.
If you pursue the point of surrender, and the point is that the gopi surrendered and functioned on that level ever after. We do surrender sometimes, and then we perfectly come back to the same platform we were before, and then we surrender again a little bit more, and come back.
But that's the process of sadhana, it's practice, because our absorption in the Lord is then just occasional. You know, now and again, depending upon the individual, the now and again is more or less now and again. Does that make sense? So it's just a matter of that's the process is that we keep going through. That's why Krishna says that the best is you just surrender immediately, like the gopis, like Maharaj Katvanga, you know, like these devotees. But if you can't do that, then you take up the practice of sadhana bhakti. Because the purpose of sadhana bhakti is to develop prema. Right? That's its whole purpose. Right? Because abhideya can develop prema. So only because it's abhideya, that's why it works. So then anything you want to connect to it, then that's fine. You can't replace it. You can't do social welfare work and claim that it's devotional service because it's not abhideya. Because it doesn't generate love for Krishna. Those things that themselves directly are dealing with Krishna, that's abhideya. Right? And so, therefore, whatever we connect to that, then that becomes abhideya. You know, like the iron and fire. So then, in this way, then, we take up the sadhana, and so we'll see is that, you know, it goes, and with time, then, remembering Krishna will become more often. And that surrender will come more often. And then sometimes it'll be less often. Then it'll come back more and more often like that. So it's just developing. Okay. So, yeah. With our present materialized senses, we cannot perceive anything of the transcendental Lord. Our present senses are to be rectified by the process of devotional service. Right, because the materialized senses are rectified by engaging them in devotional service, right? Because senses are meant to be engaged in devotional service. So if we're engaging them not, we have to rectify that and bring them to it that they are. So then you're taking the senses that have become materialized and using them in spiritual activities. And this way then they get purified so that they're no longer materialized. And then the Lord himself becomes revealed to us. Because how do you interact with someone in spiritual senses if you're not dealing in that way? So that's why the sadhana is there. It spiritualizes the materialized senses. Right. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is confirmed that the transcendental Lord can be perceived only by pure devotional service. Right. So when, as we take that step towards pure devotional service, that much we start to understand. Right. So those aspects that are pure. That's why the importance of understanding pure devotional service, so we make that endeavor. Because there's the point is it pure devotional service? Then we're trying to get pure devotional service to be consistent. Right? So we may go into the temple and take part in an activity in pure devotional service, but then the next moment we'll forget and not be engaged. But that moment was. So that's why we develop. You understand? Because there's only actually pure devotional service. So mixed devotional service, it means there's pure devotional service, and other times there's other things, or we're doing two things at once. So it's the pure devotion that attracts the Lord. So when it's not so prominent, then we attract the Lord less. When it's more prominent, we attract the Lord more. Does that make sense? Yes?
All right, so the question is, you know, on the later stages, is it one process, or we split and do two separate things, one in meditation and one, you know,
if you're talking about in Bhava Bhakti, then it would be two things at once. But generally, from what I've heard, that, you know, means, yeah, the more advanced you are, you can do them simultaneously, or they just take times when they're alone and then use that time.
Mm-hmm. You know? So sadhana continues, and then meditation.
Yes. Because it's the standard, I think, is pointed out, that the Uttamadhikaris, they always present themselves as neophytes. You know, so therefore they follow the activities, do the activities, and do those things like that. But it doesn't mean that those on the platform of prema will always be remembering. But they'll be doing these things for Krishna, their activities for Krishna. Does that make sense? But then when they're times alone, then they may be more absorbed in that way. They don't have to worry about the external. You know, like Raghunath Das, that story of Raghunath Das when he got sick.
Yeah.
Like that. So then he was just sitting and meditating on these things. And then he got sick. You know, and then people saying, how can he get sick, you know, from overeating? Yeah. So.
Yeah. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandini.